It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 544, and it's May the 9th, 1982. There was a review of a book in the Wall Street Journal this week that I found very fascinating. I haven't gotten the book yet, but it was one of these things that really caught my imagination. It's a new book called Iran, The Untold Story by Mohammed Haikal, H-E-I-K-A-L. And there were several messages to be learned just from this book review alone, and I'm sure there's much more in the book. The interesting point about this book review, it's the detail of the taking of the embassy in Iran and how the American government was told through messages of the State Department, don't bring the Shah into the United States until we have troops and fortification of the embassy because there will be riots and so forth, secure the area. So the Iranians knew that within 3 months, the Shah would be in the United States. So they got the floor plans of the embassy, and they were able to take the embassy and weaken the guards because they had 3 months to plan the taking of the hostages, and the Americans were sending messages back. A desk officer, Henry Prick, was sending messages to the State Department the Shah would be coming to the United States. So the Shah was going to be here. The Iranians knew it, so that both of them were making their moves, and it didn't just happen as it appeared on television, and it hardly ever does happen that way. And secondly, one of the things that kept the Shah hanging around for so long in Iran was that he ordered some new crowns. Now, he had one of the finest collections of diamonds in the world, but according to this book, he was dissatisfied with the crowns of his predecessor, so he commissioned Cartier's to make him a new one. And at the end of his royal career, he didn't want to leave Iran for several days because he wanted to take the crown jewels with him. And they were in the vault, and the people that kept the vault were on strike, and everyone else around Iran was, and his personal guards couldn't find them, and they had to leave without the jewels. But what kept him there so long was still wanting to take the new crown and the new jewels. And as the struggle was going on, it began in January of 78. By May of 78, his wife, the Empress Farah, first heard for the first time of the name Khomeini, and according to this author who lived in the Middle East, she said, for heaven's sakes, who is this Khomeini? Now, that's important because sometimes there's news around us, all around us, that affects our lives, our safety, our future, our country. It's all there for us to see, and if you don't want to see it, if you think that you're the grandest empress in the land and that your Shah is going to have a new crown and you're going to go on living forever in that manner, you don't see anything else that's happening around you. So in all of that time, she wasn't aware that Khomeini was waiting there in Paris and getting ready to replace her and her husband and take over the government. And the important thing about Khomeini was that even though they didn't know who he was, they didn't really know who he was, this author says Khomeini knew exactly who he was fighting, and that is the difference in surviving and in the game of surviving. Know your enemy and know who you're fighting. And this Khomeini said to the author of this book, the Shah was nothing as a figure and neither was his Savak, and that was a powerful army trained by the CIA. Ours was a revolution against the army, and he assessed the fact that you don't fight the Shah with arms. You don't fight arms with arms. You can never win. Khomeini said you cannot confront the army. Arms cannot be fought with arms. The only way to fight the army is to disarm it. And so when it came to the push and shove, the soldiers lined up with the masses and the people and would not defend the Shah, and that's how they won the revolution. He said despite their uniforms, they were of the people. Do not attack the army in its breast, but in its heart. Appeal to the soldiers' hearts, even if they fire on you or kill you, because you will prove that blood is more powerful than the sword. And that is what happened. And I mention that because we live in a military area, a very highly concentrated area. This is Military Week out here in Monterey, California, on the peninsula. And we have installations here of the Presidio, which is the oldest Army installation in the United States. It's a spy school. There's Fort Ord. There's Hunter Liggett with a laser beam weapons, Kashaw with the satellites, the Navy Postgraduate School, the Monterey Institute for Foreign Studies that trains spies to go all over the world. And the point is that many of them listen. I get phone calls and letters from these people who are listening to this program, to this news analysis. And they know that when they go out and overseas to kill other people and to maim people and to help put in fascist dictatorships in those countries, that what they come home with is drug addiction or the Agent Orange with the possibility of deformed children and wives. It's carried on now, some of these diseases and chemicals from Southeast Asia are carried on to the families. They'll come to homes that are worth $100,000 or $200,000, no savings. The Social Security money will run out. Hard to find jobs when they get home. Racism worse than ever. No education for their children. Transportation sky high. No place to live or to be educated. So why go all the way out over to these other countries to kill and maim? If they were sensible, they would study their own country. Being in the services is a job. You earn a living, but there must be a better way. And it comes to the push and shove. I'm sure that many people will put down the weapons. I know one in particular who was teaching killing at Fort Ord, and he'd been to Vietnam one time, came back, reenlisted. And when I first started this broadcast, this was 10 years ago, he put down the weapons and the tools of teaching the weapons, stopped teaching the killing. They wanted to court-martial him, sent him to a mental hospital back east in South Carolina, and he got out of the Army. They discharged him. He asked me to defend him. I didn't even know him, but defend him on the basis that the military was lying to their people, that this was a country of assassins, of political chicanery, and that the armed services were going into a war that they had lied about. First, they thought about court-martialing and a court case. But then they let him out of the Army, and he's out, and we're still friends. And the point is that he realized that he was teaching lies. He had been taught lies. And later, he was a victim of Agent Orange and had some problems with himself and his children. And at that time, it was too early to even identify what was causing those problems. But the point is that what Khomeini says is don't fight weapons with weapons. Fight and teach the Army, or teach any person who's willing to hear or listen, the truth about what is going on, and that's the only way to make a better world. You can't defend what's wrong and hope to come out ahead in the end. There was an article in the paper this morning onto another subject that is coincidental, to something I said a long time ago about John Hinckley. The trial is going on now, the very weak, feeble trial for the man who shot Ronald Reagan and Press Secretary Brady and a Secret Service agent and a policeman in Washington, D.C. over a year ago. The entire trial is a sham. It's similar to all the other political assassination trials. It's a weak prosecution. He's a poor, sick boy. Mommy didn't understand him. He wandered alone out there with nobody loving him. Send him home to us, and we'll give him the care he needed. It's better than a mental hospital. And they're pulling the same BS they pulled through all these other stories. This was a fellow that traveled around the country, worked with the Nazi Party, had funding, traveled with a lot of different people. And in this morning's San Francisco Examiner, an article from the Baltimore Sun, Hinckley's mystery girlfriend, their four-year relationship could help reveal what makes him tick. And you better believe it would. He has a mystery woman that neither the defense or the prosecution has listed as a witness. He's known her for 4 years. She lives out here in California. She visited him in Lubbock, Texas, and she has not been asked to be called. Now, when I said that John Hinckley, that I believed John Hinckley was the John who was parked in front of my house in January of last year, and I made notes of who he was, the license number, called the Secret Service, and the FBI, after Ronald Reagan was shot, they came down to my house. They told me it didn't matter if he was there or if he was with anybody. That didn't interest them at all. And I said, if I'm sitting in my home and this man has done this much damage in Washington, it would be interesting to know who he is and who he has contact with. Now, this story comes out about his seeing her quite a bit, knowing her. She was into the music scene. She was in plays in Chicago, in productions there, an actress. And she lives out in California. Some letters he had. Lynn wants me in California. I don't have to have a college degree. And he goes out to her. This scene where I believe that was John Hinckley in front of my house took place about 2 weeks after an article in the San Francisco Chronicle saying that I made connections of the Nazis in this country and overseas to the murder of John Kennedy and up to John Lennon. This was an article in January, and Lennon had been murdered in December, just before that. And I was making the connections of Mark David Chapman, Lennon's assassin, to the same CIA group that had been part of the past political assassinations. And this was in the San Francisco Chronicle. And then a few weeks later, here's this fellow who has diaries on John Lennon and Mark David Chapman, who keeps copies of the Warren Report at home. He's following and studying the Kennedy assassination. He's the member of the Posse Comitatus, a group that want to kill federal agents. He's a member of Nazi groups throughout the country. He's telephonically in contact with people in Colorado, in Tennessee. He picks up guns that the prosecution isn't even talking about. This whole trial is a charade, as are all the other trials. But now they said in the paper this morning about this contact in California. I wrote down a very careful description. In my mind, it's very clear who the woman was who was John Hinckley, and I'll follow that up next week. Call the Secret Service again tomorrow and the FBI and ask them why they passed this thing off for so long, because he had mobility. And he also said he was from Santa Barbara. They were from Santa Barbara, and they could be there where Ronald Reagan lives and hopefully try to shoot him there instead of in Washington, D.C., if they could get close enough to him. That is one of the most disgusting stories, to see this, that they've known for all this time about these other contacts, and the trial simply is limited to whether he was sane at the moment you shoot somebody. How do you define the exact moment when you have target practice and weapons and you travel all over the country with guns and ammunition and you can pick it up anywhere you want and you're practicing your shooting and you're writing messages about the person and you're photographed in front of the White House and you've stalked them, which is pretty good, and emulating Artie Bremmer, who shot George Wallace. Bremmer was following Richard Nixon, and then he conveniently shot Wallace and got him out of the running against Nixon for those Republican votes. And this character, Hinckley, was stalking Jimmy Carter and then shoots at Reagan, which would make George Bush, the CIA director, president of the United States. Jack Anderson had an article this past week, Tapes Reveal the Chaos After the Hinckley Shots. And it tells about the power struggle that Alexander Haig had when he said, I am in charge, and got up there on the rostrum and wanted to ignore the Constitution and the line of succession. But what Jack Anderson said was that when Alexander Haig called George Bush, who was in Texas, in Hinckley country down there in Texas, they had much in common, the Hinckley family and George Bush, Haig told Bush on the telephone, there's been an incident in Washington. The phone wasn't secure, and this was the message. And minutes later, a telex message told the Bush party that Reagan had been shot in the back. Now, when Haig called Bush, he doesn't say why he's calling him or what's happening. He says an incident, instead of making it as serious as he is. And the implication here is that Bush wanted the attention and wanted to get back and wanted to take the attention off himself, whereas Haig wanted the attention on himself, and that he didn't use the Andrews Air Force Base to get to the White House lawn, that he used the normal channels, because unlike Haig, he did not want to appear to usurping the authority of an incapacitated president. Of course, he didn't want to appear that way because he was going to be the next president. So he just slowly went his way and got into the White House. But this article says that when Haig called him, he didn't even tell him the president had been shot. The issue of the trial, insanity finding, this is the headline of one article called The Freedom for Hinckley. He will be free and he can go home to mommy if they find him insane. Another article from the Washington Post Service, prosecutors must prove that Hinckley was sane. Well, the prosecutors won't prove Hinckley was sane because they're not going to admit into evidence all the places he traveled, all the people he contacted, how he purchased the weapons, who paid for his staying at the Sheraton Hotel up in New Haven in Washington, how he got in the office building across the street from the CIA, and I got some information I'll share with you next week on the location of the hotel, where he was, and his relationship to the Central Intelligence Agency and the Secret Service, how Hinckley got there. Los Angeles Times has an article, Hinckley's mental state emerges as the lone issue. It isn't the lone issue. These assassins, or these pairs of assassins, or the one who is along with the actual gunman, have teams. They work together. They're seen in other states. They're seen in the same state. At the scene of the crime, they're present. They're photographed at the scene of the crime. And in comes the prosecution, who can't dare give a strong prosecution because the defense attorney, as I mentioned a long time ago, for this operation of the Hinckley family is Edward Bennett Williams at his office, and they represented everybody from Robert Vesco to Lucky Luciana to the Mullen Associates at the time of Watergate and to E. Howard Hunt at the time of Watergate, Richard Helms, all the Watergate CIA, all the CIA establishment and the organized crime figures and the mob syndicate. So with an attorney representing Edward Bennett Williams, representing John Hinckley Jr., I don't believe for a minute that the prosecution is going to try and buck up to, against it. Now, they tried that food testimony this week at the trial. The doctors got up who examined Hinckley, and they asked him if it was possible that he had too much pizza and soda. And that's how he ended up at these hotels and these locations and by the White House and so forth. That's sort of like the Dan White Twinkie case. They wanted to make it a diet. And Dr. Rosen of Lubach said he gave him tranquilizers and so forth. But the question was, could he have too much food? And he wrote messages about the Beatles and John Lennon, and those were idols of his. They weren't his idols. You don't go around with the Nazi party in various states, in Illinois, Ohio, and so forth, with the Gestapo and idolize John Lennon. This is more stuff coming out of the news media, and they just eat it up. Now, one of the important things about this trial is Brady's memory dims, so he can't testify. That was in the newspapers this week. Why can't Brady testify? Because his brains were blown out, and the jury may feel sorry for Brady. And you don't want him to be sorry. If you're going to try and get Hinckley off and back to the family, you don't feel sorry for him. So they don't allow Brady in so they can see the damage they did to his brain. They just say his memory is dim. His memory is probably zero. Nobody has heard or seen Brady talk except grunting some sounds or seen him walk. But God forbid you feel sorry for Brady, then you may be pretty hard on prosecuting Hinckley. So Brady is not identified. It doesn't matter whether he can testify or not. He could come in a wheelchair so they could see the victim and how his life is from this moment on. Now, they put a judge, U.S. Judge Barrington Parker, very good strategy in this case. They put a black judge on the case because then he won't look like he's prejudiced against this little Nazi rich kid, okay? They did that with the Rosenbergs. They put Judge Kaufman, and they had Roy Cohn, a Jew, help prosecute, and Louis Neiser. If Jews are hard on Rosenberg, then Jews aren't communists. And if blacks are easy on the Nazis, you know, they're not going to show the hate for hate. Okay, so they put a U.S. Judge Barrington Parker, a nice black judge who listened to the case and do just what Judge Kaufman. Judge Kaufman prosecuted the Rosenbergs, but he's not going to be hard on Hinckley this time, see, because he's a Nazi. It's a reverse thing. He's going to let him off to show that he's not filled with hate. He's not going to justify, and he's not going to take in any evidence also of the background of John Hinckley as he listens to this case. There's also mentioned that he had newspaper articles about the Warren Commission. I said before about the slaying of John Kennedy and the diary of Arthur Bremer, who shot George Wallace, and the story of the John Lennon shooting. I published in Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped in 1972, The Pattern of the American Assassin, the domino theory of the American assassin, that James Earl Ray could read about Oswald and shoot Martin Luther King, then Sirhan read about Ray and Oswald, so he could shoot Robert Kennedy, and all the assassins that would follow would read the history of the past assassins, and then that would be their role model. So now they've pulled out the Warren Commission report, the Lennon thing, the Artie Bremer. I'm sure that John Hinckley Jr., coming out of Lubbock, Texas, and Denver, Colorado, with his wealthy CIA family, didn't give a bean about George Wallace or Artie Bremer or anything about that political milieu. Most of these kids were too young to even go back that time, and I doubt that he really did care that much about it. He wrote scrambling notes, heroes are meant to be killed. But who are his heroes? Maybe his real hero, subconsciously, is daddy's friend or business associate like George Bush from Houston, Texas, and the CIA multinational oil group that they were part of. Maybe he really wanted Reagan to be shot to prove to his dad that he could help dad's friend, George Bush, get in. His father supported Bush's candidacy, and maybe he wanted dad's approval. That psyched that one out, that he really wanted dad's approval by making his friend Bush president, so he shot Reagan. That's more the script and nothing to do with those kinds of heroes. He wasn't brought up like that at all. Now, before I get to some other news, I want to continue part four on the Falklands, the British-Argentine confrontation, with just a few of the headlines and important stories in the news and some interesting articles pertaining to this subject. As I've said for a long time, for those of you who didn't catch the first 3 weeks that I talked about this subject, the conflict of the Falklands is the sea routes, the entree to Antarctica. Antarctica has been built up for years. It was staked out in the 30s by Admiral Byrd, by Adolf Hitler in late 30s, 38, 39, that there is atomic energy down there. There's desalinated water. There are roads and industry. It is a prototype for space stations. It controls that area, controls three major seas. It is strategic for future wars, Star Wars, space wars. And yet the British, the Americans, can't really talk about what it's doing there, what the trouble is, because we armed this thing secretly. We have had secret passes to get there. It is one of the best kept secrets of the past 30 or 40 years. The bringing of Nazis to this country, to Antarctica, to Argentina, to South America, with the technology for the weapons for the next war. And along those lines, to update this week, the article in the San Jose Mercury this last week by George Will, also in the Washington Post, there's more at stake in the Falklands than the interest of 1,800 islanders. It took them 3 weeks to publish this. The Washington Post had no articles of this type. The New York Times had two up until now. And what George Will is saying, that the crisis has focused attention on the proximity of islands to important sea lanes, and the Argentine foreign minister recently said there is something much more important down there. The Argentine presence in the island is important, but the controlling of this area controls the South Atlantic politically and economically. Isn't that cute that they just caught on? That politically and economically, the sea lanes are determined down in that area and are of primary importance. Another article from the Christian Science Monitor this last week, Antarctic resources may spark the next worldwide dispute. And this article tells about the dispute of the Falkland Islands and the South Georgia Islands, and the troubling issues will present themselves in the neighboring Antarctic and surrounding Southern Ocean. Although it has no indigenous population other than penguins, the Antarctic is more than a block of ice. Now, that's a lie. There's no large population, but there are many, many colonies down there, well built over a long period of years. And then this article goes on to say the Antarctic region was singled out in 1957 for scientific study. They make a jump in this article from penguins to 1957 with none of the important and secret trips that were taken down to Antarctica and what went on down there. But the conclusion of the article in the Christian Science Monitor is, and there is an international framework here for proposals for the Antarctic Consortium, that huge multinational corporations maybe should go down there and take a look and get together, which we know they'll do. They'll take one more continent, serve it for their purposes, but there's something even more interesting about Antarctica. Now, one of the subscribers to World Watchers Back East, one of my great listeners who follows through, there are very many that follow through with articles on the subjects that I talk about each week, and one particular person has been following this Antarctic area right along with me. And I had articles from the National Geographic that I shared with you last week on that atomic energy and the buildings down there and so forth. She sent me a copy of an article from National Geographic, October 1959, called What We've Accomplished in the Antarctic by Rear Admiral George J. Dufek, D-U-F-E-K, What We Accomplished. Now, this article, page 548, goes into Admiral Byrd's trips down the sailing ship 1939, the Bear. And Admiral Byrd said, in quotes, "I believe the Antarctic will play a very important role in the coming space age. The South Pole is on a platform. The Antarctic continent remains stationary as all other points of the Earth's surface move from west to east with the Earth's rotation. Thus, a satellite is a polar orbit to be observed from the South Pole every time it passes around the Earth. Such satellites, when eventually manned, could be controlled better from the South Pole than any other spot on the Earth's land surface. By control, I mean give out instructions for the pilot to break out of orbit and land." The article goes on, National Geographic, "Antarctica is an air hub of the future. In this era of fantastic, ever-increasing speeds, don't neglect the future importance of remote areas on the Earth." This was written in 1959. "After the establishment of our U.S. Antarctic bases during the International Geophysical Year," that was 2 years earlier, "we could land to the South Pole by aircraft within 5 days of departing from San Francisco. It's been a long dream to build a runway on solid ground in Antarctic equipped with facilities of a modern airport in the United States. And with such an airport, we can fly planes in and out 12 months a year. Furthermore, it will open the era of trans-Antarctic flights between Australia and New Zealand." I mentioned those last week, from South Africa to Australia to Antarctica and then New Zealand, and South America and Africa, just as many U.S. planes are traveling today. And it discusses the growth of population in other areas and possibly using this to confront that. It refers to the growth of populations on the other continents. Today, if you wish to fly to South America, New Zealand, it tells you how if you use the Antarctic route, you can save 8,600 miles. Someday, an airstrip of at least 5,000 feet will be constructed there, and that will be a great day for Antarctica and the whole southern area. And it refers to the Pan American World Airways flying down there with particular stewardesses, and that it will become a tourist paradise, I'm sure, like Guyana. Remember how Jim Jones sold Guyana to various members of our population, and not over 900 died down there? Well, this article in 1959 in the National Geographic was saying, as a matter of fact, Argentine and Chilean ships already take tourists to the northernmost fingers of Antarctica, and when the snow melts, is ice skating, hiking, mountain climbing, and et cetera. An even more interesting section from a book that was sent to me by the same person, it's called Antarctica, My Destiny, The Personal History of the Last of the Great Polar Explorers by Captain Finn Rone, R-O-N-N-E, published in 1979 by Hastings House. Now, this has to do with General Curtis LeMay, and who was chief of the Air Corps of Research and Development, working with Mr. Rone. Curtis LeMay was one of the persons on the board of directors of National Geographic that was particularly interested in this magazine in the Antarctic area and the explorations down there with members of the CIA. Mr. Rone talks about his work with Office of Naval Research and with the North American Newspaper Alliance, who were to buy his stories about Antarctica. Now, Priscilla Johnson from North American Newspaper Alliance worked with Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union. This was an alliance set up by the Central Intelligence Agency, and that is the syndicated news that you were to get from Antarctica by these explorers. Now, Admiral Byrd lived a block away from this Mr. Rone, and he describes in 1946 the Operation High Jump. That's the one I described several weeks ago on this program, of Admiral Byrd and Navy Operation, how they went down there. And this particular person was competing with Admiral Byrd, and Byrd thwarted everything he did and didn't want to share the information when they first started out. When he wanted to go down there and get money to go down to explore, he said, "I had a powerful opponent, one determined to thwart my interest in the U.S. role of discovery of exploration. Although I was an immigrant from Norway with no American family ties or powerful connections, my interests were similar to Byrd. But Byrd wanted monopoly of Antarctica. It wasn't a free area. that people could go down and explore, and it never has been. It's been a top secret area where, as I say, you have to have special permission. You get fingerprinted and so forth, and it's very hard to get there. This book describes the relationship of Lowell Thomas to the people going to Antarctica, and of course Lowell Thomas worked both with the Central Intelligence Agency, Lawrence Arabia, and many relationships to our spy agencies in this country while he was live as a newspaper man. This fellow finally gets into a working relationship with Admiral Byrd, and they share information, and he wrote to him in a letter. He complained to Senator Francis Case that the polar matters were controlled by the Pentagon people, sympathetic to Admiral Byrd's interests, and he had reason to believe they would block his expedition, that Byrd considers Antarctica his own country, and there's no competition in this field. I'll take a break now. It's 30 minutes. We'll take a one-minute break and go on to the importance of the Falklands and that part of the world to the United States military.
This concludes the first...